You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Please welcome to the stage Jaspreet Kaur. Brown women have worn shisha in their clothes since the 17th century, and now they're worn more beautifully as if they weren't meant for me. I see them on runways weaved into their embroidery so cheaply when for centuries their reflections were enough for a man to fall in love so deeply, because brown women have been wearing nuts since the 16th century and now they're worn more beautifully as if they weren't meant for me. I remember one time I wore a bindi to school. I thought it was pretty, but they called me a fool. They said, go back to your country with your stinking clothes. And now I see them in almost every music video. So I say, hey, what now makes it so cool? Because brown women have been wearing files since the first century, and now they're worn more beautifully as if they weren't meant for me. Their chimes alone acted as inspiration for poetry. You should read the Kilapathikaram. Maybe, or maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong to assume that the same mouths that made the word immigrant so dirty are the same mouths craving for a curry on a Friday night or a chai tea latte, because brown women have been wearing mendi valehat since the Vedic century, and now they're worn more beautifully as if they weren't meant for me. There was patterns on my palms that could put petals to shame. Their stains are enough for lions to lose their tame. Their curves and lines are considered hypnotic. But now I bet your henna tattoos make you feel so damn hipster and so damn exotic. I'm not saying that our lives can't be shared and symbiotic. I'm just saying that we shouldn't have been degraded in the process. Whilst they mocked our English, our linguistics and the symbolic, we were crying to be cut loose from the shackles of colonialism. Oh, the irony of brown women scraping their heavenly dark skin with beauty cream, trying to be lighter. While some fake up their tans, we cry to be whiter. My thick hair was decided for me before I was even in the womb. And let me assure you that my brown skin is not some kind of costume. We tried our best to adopt a cultural milieu. We molded ourselves into the surrounding area like glue, but who are we trying to fool? We just look more out of place like animals in a zoo, but assimilation is a complete separate issue, and I'll leave that to Fanon to discuss, because we shouldn't have to blend. For once, can we not pretend that my beautiful culture is not a trend to be passed on like bell-bottom jeans and feathered hair? This is my beauty, and I'm happy to share, but not at the cost of belittlement. And not in combination with a comment on my mother's accent. We have been too busy living in the dust of an empire that burnt our worth, that we refuse to grow from the ashes. But I am no longer ashamed. I shall wear my gargle along my long lashes, and I shall wear my seeds with pride so we can flourish. So sure, wrap yourself up in a sari whilst we unravel ourselves from self-hatred and low self-esteem. Unweave the oppression and we'll let go of the victimhood stitched into the seams. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Jaspreet Kaur. I'm a spoken word poet. I'm an author of Brown Girl Like Me, which I'll be talking about a little bit later. And I'm also an educator. I spent a number of years teaching history, sociology, and politics in secondary schools down in London. And I'm currently a research fellow at the University of Edinburgh, working on my next few books and my next piece of research on the concept of quiet feminism. But the reason why we're here today, and what I wanted us to really think about, what I wanted us to explore and reflect on, is a hot topic at the moment, around cultural appropriation, which is what that first poem was entitled after, and how we as a society, we as a community, can appreciate one another's cultures without appropriating them. And like I said, it's quite a controversial topic, it's quite a hot topic, hence why we're discussing it here in Rebel Rouser. But what I wanted to do today is not only define it, not only unpack it, but for us to understand what it might feel like for those that may have their cultures appropriated, and what can we do better as a society to make sure that we're having more of a harmonious cultural exchange, that we are appreciating one another's cultures without offending and without appropriating. Now, to kick off and to start off why cultural appropriation was something I was so interested in as a researcher, as an educator, as a poet, how did I come across this topic and why was it something that I wanted to dive into? Well, to share that story, I've got to go back a number of years, back to when I was about 13 years old. And I grew up in the heart of East London, which we might know is a very diverse and multicultural part of the UK. I grew up with all walks of life, different cultures, different backgrounds, different faiths. And despite the fact that I was growing up around incredible South Asian women in my family, in my community, what I couldn't see was much representation of women that looked like me in the mainstream. And what I mean by that is that I never saw brown women on TV screens. I never saw us in films and shows. I didn't hear us in music. I didn't read us in literature. And I definitely didn't see us in the classroom on our national curriculum either. And that never quite made sense to me, because I knew that South Asians and South Asian women made up a huge part of British society and British history. But why was it that we were being completely ignored and completely erased? And why was it that when we did see South Asian women, we would always see these really outdated stereotypes of Asian women being conveyed as passive, as weak, as docile, lacking autonomy? And a lot of this kind of victimhood storytelling when we did see ourselves. And then a number of years later, after I left school, left uni, I went into teacher training, I became a history teacher. And even then, 10 years later, I was still seeing these same stereotypes and this sense of erasure of South Asian women being conveyed those 10, 15 years later. And what I could also see was in the classroom, even though South Asian girls were academically doing very well, some of the smartest in the country at GCSE and at A-levels, many of them going on to doing degrees and postgraduate degrees. However, in the classroom, were really lacking this kind of self-confidence in themselves, would never put their hands up in class, would never put themselves forward for prestigious school roles. And I couldn't quite make sense of why that was all happening. And all of that led me to writing this book, Brown Girl Like Me, The Essential Guidebook and Manifesto for South Asian Girls and Women. Because for me, a book like this never existed growing up. I wished it had. I wished I had a guidebook on how to navigate an intersectional identity made up of all these different parts of who I am. And to hear stories of South Asian women, not only our struggles and the difficulties we go through, but also a story of celebration and achievement and resilience. So it's packed with beautiful stories of Asian women from across the UK, from a range of different demographics, girls as young as 13, all the way up to women in their 80s and 90s to really get an intergenerational perspective of who the Asian woman is. And along that journey, when I was doing the research for this book, I thought about, okay, what themes, what topics, what chapters is it going to cover? And it covers everything from mental health, to the education system, to body image, to love and relationships, to social media. And one of the topics that came up was cultural appropriation. And that is the one we're going to be diving into today, about what is it? How can it be harmful? And what can we as a community do to do better to make sure that we aren't appropriating one another's cultures? So before I go into the definition and what the Oxford Dictionary has decided to define cultural appropriation as, what I really want us to understand is what it might feel like. So I'm actually going to share a little reading from the book about what appropriation actually feels like in real life, in real time. Mum and I were having our usual 5 o'clock cup of tea. Tesco value nice biscuits on the table, my nephews running around the living room, the TV on in the background. Our daily cup of jar had become something of a routine during my early 20s, but it hadn't always been that way. As an adolescent, my relationship with my mum was tricky. I was a book smart but rebellious teenager, keen to explore the ways of other people my age and in some sense denying my culture, who I was and where I came from. On the other hand, my mum wanted to keep me close to my roots, reminding me of who I was and where I came from, which I often rejected. It was only as I got older that I started to take some pride in parts of my culture, but we'll come back to that later. At some point during our daily catch-up, Iggy Azalea's music video, Bounce, appeared on the screen. She was wearing a red lehenga with gold embroidery, a tikka resting on her forehead, a dupatta draped across her head, and a group of Bollywood backup dancers behind her. In case you aren't aware, Azalea is not a Bollywood actress. She is a white Australian rapper. My mum glanced at the screen and said, "Doesn't she look nice in that lehenga?" I didn't really think much of her comment at the time. Mum has always been a fan of seeing what new styles were in, whether velvet had come back in fashion, what new colours were on trend. It was only when she made her next comment that I started to pay more attention. She said, "I wish I could have worn them more when I was her age." It broke my heart. I began to see the double standards that existed around fashion, how a culture that I once thought was too foreign for Western eyes had suddenly become trendy, a culture I had grown up denying. In that moment, I felt so sad. In that moment, I understood the meaning of cultural appropriation, but more importantly, I understood what it felt like. My mum migrated to the UK in 1977 at the age of 18 to marry my dad. My mum was and still is absolutely stunning. A long brown plait was hidden under her dupatta, big brown eyes, a long pointy Punjabi nose. The marriage and the wedding preparations began, and my mum flew over to the UK in August of 1977, her first time on an aeroplane. She had only ever seen my dad's photograph. Dad must have been a right looker, or maybe it was his 70s fashion sense that had my mum swooning. Anyhow, Dad picked her up from the airport, and they got married in October of that same year. And they've looked after each other ever since. Like most first wave immigrants, they found those early years very tough. Mum spent her days working the till in our corner shop in East London, whilst Dad worked two other jobs. Acceptance of differences was still in its early days during the 1970s in East London. So Mum had to constantly try to ignore the murmurs of the P word under so many breaths, and the sniggers around how she dressed. Soon, her salwar kameez had to stay home. Instead, she saved up enough spare change to buy herself a pair of jeans and wear my dad's naff-naff jacket every single day. It became her new armor. It was clear that to assimilate into British culture, there was no space for her salwar kameez. It was too different, too colorful, too brash, too foreign. So I thought I'd share that little reading from the chapter Cultural Appropriation to just highlight what in real time cultural appropriation actually is. And that little story there of my mum is showing how for her, when she migrated to the UK, she didn't feel safe wearing her traditional Punjabi clothing. But now, years later, those same items that we may have denied ourselves from or been embarrassed of or been scared to wear are now being seen as fashion items, now being seen as accessories, now being commodified in Western culture. And that is really the definition of what cultural appropriation is. It is when a more dominant part of society takes elements from a less dominant part of society and commodifies them, makes money out of it, makes it fashionable, makes it cool, makes it exotic, when that host community, where it came from, were never able to reap those same benefits. There's also been other research done into cultural appropriation over the years. There's been other definitions given to it. There was a researcher back in 2008. He was a contemporary philosopher. His name was James Young. He looked at how specifically in art and in history, we've seen examples of appropriation, things like object appropriation, when, as we know, colonization taking place across the world, when objects have been taken from other countries without permission, have been stolen and taken to the Western world. He also spoke about things like voice appropriation. That's when more dominant parts of society take knowledge and understanding from less dominant parts of society and convey it as if it's their own knowledge and not appreciate where that history or knowledge may have originally come from. So that's the research and the definitions that have come up over the years. But what I want us to really look into today is what can we do better? As we know, our societies are going to continue to be multicultural. They're going to continue to be diverse. So how can we make sure we are appreciating one another's cultures without offending, without taking? And how can we have more of a harmonious and more balanced cultural exchange so that people don't feel like elements are being taken without their permission? So to start off with, before we get into, okay, what can we do as individuals for other cultures? For me, the starting point as a South Asian woman was actually looking at myself a little bit. And what I realized was through writing this book and doing this research, and the reason for why I wrote it was to help stop things like appropriation happening. We need to make sure those host communities, those minority communities, those marginalized communities actually have a voice and actually feel like they're being heard, actually feel like they're the ones being able to tell their story and tell their narrative so that we can educate one another on our own cultures. So for a lot of this conversation, that is really the starting point. Those host communities, those that are facing the appropriation, being able to share their narrative, to share their story, to share their voice. And obviously as a writer, as a poet, as an educator, I feel a lot of that can be done through the arts. A lot of that can be done through books. A lot of that can be done in the classroom, but it can also be done in our homes and in our communities and in spaces like this. So to me, that is one of the starting points, that the host communities can help educate those that are outside of it. The second part is also that the communities themselves take pride in their cultures. For a long time, growing up here in the UK, I didn't love my culture. I didn't love my history or my faith. And the reason being was growing up, like other teenagers, like other young people, wanting to fit in, I denied myself of all the beautiful things that made up my culture, my history, my heritage, just so that I could fit in to those around me. Things like losing traditions along the way, like every Sunday, my family had a tradition of what was known as hair wash day, where my mum would wash mine and my siblings' hair. She'd sit me down in front of her and she'd rub coconut oil into my hair. She'd braid it into a nice, tight, neat plait. And that was me ready to be sent off to school for the rest of the week. But when I went to secondary school, I heard a group of girls sniggering about the hair oil in my hair, and I ran back home and said to my mum, please never put oil in my hair again. Despite that being a cultural tradition amongst many South Asian cultures for thousands of years, it's something my grandmother did for my mum, it was something my mum was doing for me. But because I was trying so hard to fit in, I denied myself of that beautiful part of my culture. But now we can see things like hair oil or this concept of oiling being brought into kind of mainstream Western culture, being sold back to us in interesting ways and being commercialized in interesting ways. So it's funny how these things go full circle. And it's only now, as an adult, that I've really started to become more in tune with my culture, my faith, my identity, my history. And that is something that a lot of migrants, a lot of immigrants, a lot of people from the cultural diaspora actually go through. It's known as this cultural diasporic journey that when we're young, we're very connected to our cultures. Before the age of four, because we're mainly with our families or our communities, we're very connected to our culture, our faith, perhaps. But as we grow older, we detach ourselves from our cultures just so we can fit in. But then we go through this third stage in our lives when we're perhaps in our late 20s, our 30s, our 40s or beyond. And that's when we try to reconnect with our cultures and our identities again. So it's kind of this three-wave journey that we all go on. So that's the host communities, what we can do better so that our cultures are better understood and so that we also start to love our cultures again. But what can everybody else do? What can everybody else outside of those communities and outside of those cultures do to make sure they're not appropriating and to make sure they're appreciating? Now, I thought I'd give a bit of context of where it's okay to be involved in someone else's cultural heritage, because I get asked this question all the time. Where is it okay to wear a bindi? Where is it okay to wear a sari? Where can I actually be involved in that community or that culture by appreciating it and respecting it? And where is it actually not okay to do those things? So I'll give you one example. Back in 2017, when I was getting married, one of my white best friends who was coming to the wedding said she really wanted to be involved in the South Asian culture and the traditions that were going to be going on at the wedding. And she said, I really want to understand it all so I can really be a part of it. And she sat down with me over a coffee. We sat there for hours, me explaining the traditions of a Punjabi wedding, the ceremonies that were going to take place. I explained to her all the kind of cultural fashion elements, the food, the music, but also the importance of some of the more religious and spiritual parts of a Punjabi Sikh wedding. She sat there for hours listening. She was even taking notes. And at the actual wedding, she borrowed one of my mum's Indian outfits. She wore a bindi. She really was a part of that cultural moment. And that is where it is absolutely okay to be a part of that cultural context. That is appreciating the culture. That is not appropriating it, because in that context, in that time, it makes absolute sense. Whereas wearing a sari or another cultural item as a costume to a party, to a Halloween party, to fancy dress up, is where it's being seen as more of appropriation rather than appreciating that culture. Appreciating it means understanding where it comes from, understanding the context of where it is meant to be, and not just wearing it as a costume or an item or an accessory. So that was kind of one example in real life that I thought I'd share with you. But I'm going to share another quick reading from the book, again, outlining how can we appreciate one another's cultures without appropriating them. And this is going to give you some really clear stages of if you're ever asking yourself, am I appropriating in this moment, to ask yourself these three questions. When trying to figure out whether you're appropriating another culture or not, I found that writer Nisha Shaw's essay, Appropriate Cultural Appropriation, such a fitting title, was a handy guide. When it comes to cultural symbiosis, we can usually fit the issues into three clear categories. She calls them guests, tourists, or invaders. For example, a guest sharing cultural aspects is not too much of a problem. You could be two friends, often swapping clothes and learning from each other. As a guest, you would hope that you'd want to learn and understand more about you and your culture. My best friend, who I just described before, would be a good example of a guest. A tourist, for example, a white person visiting a South Asian country, can sometimes be seen as a little bit irritating from the host communities, but you can give them a pass for acts of appropriation in that context. They may sometimes violate house rules, but you hope that they will come to be enlightened and learn about the culture whilst they are in that space. Tourists and backpackers are usually given this pass. Finally, there are invaders. Someone who has deliberately invaded your space without warning, commodifying and profiteering from aspects of your culture without any regard for its history, context, or how it might make people from that background feel. It makes no sense for the invader to be adopting that cultural accessory or object in the given context, time, or place. So if you're ever questioning whether you're appropriating something or not, see whether you fit into those three categories. If it's the latter, press pause and reassess. We all need to be especially alert to things that are held sacred in other cultures. Sure, we have the right to express ourselves through our clothes and what we wear, but you can see why wearing a t-shirt with a Hindu god or any religious deity or symbol might be a bit insensitive. When trying to consider whether you're appropriating or not, try and ask yourself some questions first. Here I'd like to emphasize Susan Scadafi's three S's: source, significance, and similarity. Think about the source community. Who are they? What is their history? Do they perhaps have a background of exploitation, slavery, or maybe even genocide? Does your participation benefit or hinder the community? Its significance. Is it a sacred object? What weight and meaning does it hold? How is it represented through that product? Is it deemed or demeaned or made fun of? And finally, similarity. Is it copying a cultural object or concept that originally belonged to another culture? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, you may hopefully have learnt why it may be offensive to the source community. And again, it's time to press pause and reassess. So hopefully, those two models that I've just shared there, the first one being guest, tourist, invader, the second one being source, significance, and similarity, hopefully those two models kind of help all of us in moments where we might be questioning, are we appropriating another culture or not? We use those two models to ask ourselves those questions of, okay, is this the right place to do this? Is this the right context? Could this be significant to somebody else? Could it be sacred to another culture? Could I be offending? Asking ourselves all those questions before we make that choice, or before we go into that moment, or before we step into a place or a time where it could be appropriating. And ultimately, all those things that I've just mentioned about what we can do better, it all relates to these conversations we have been having about how can we be better allies to one another? How can we be better allies to minority and marginalized communities? Ultimately, all of it is around this concept of doing this education. A lot of it is this self-education that we need to do for ourselves. And a lot of the time when I'm doing talks like this, I do a lot of workshops around not only cultural appropriation, but things like microaggressions, other topics around identity politics, other topics around gender equality. A lot of it is around better allyship, is really that self-education that we need to be doing. Not only in public spaces, but in the private sphere as well, in our homes, amongst our families, amongst our friends, amongst our communities, Are we doing that education of understanding what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes, understanding what it's like to be in another culture or community, understanding their histories? That is one of the reasons why I became an educator, why I became a teacher, because I saw that importance of education. And a lot of that doesn't just take place in the classroom. As we know, it can happen outside of that too. There's a really brilliant book that I definitely recommend too. It's by an Irish black author called Emma Dabiri. She wrote a book called Allyship to Coalition. And in her book, what she's talking about is that, yes, the first step is allyship, but what we now need to see is this move to coalition. This idea of once we've educated ourselves, once we've made sure we're not just bystanders to injustice, we're actually standing in coalition with minority and marginalized communities in that fight when they need us. So I just wanted to recommend that book as well as a bit of reading for anybody who does want to do more of that self-education, anyone who does want to be a better ally to minority or marginalized communities. How do we move from allyship to coalition? Now, before we finish up, I just wanted to give a few more quick examples of appreciation versus appropriation. A really famous case a couple years ago in the fashion industry by Gucci a number of years ago, back in 2019, was called out for appropriation because on their runways and big fashion shows, they were using the hijab and they were using the turban as a fashion accessory. And for hopefully most of us here can understand why in that moment, using a hijab or using a turban as a fashion accessory can be a really harmful thing for both of those cultures and faiths. We think about post 9/11, wearing a hijab, wearing a turban in some parts of the world can get you killed. We've seen the statistics on 300% plus incidents of Islamophobia since 9/11. We know that only days after 9/11 took place, a turban-wearing Sikh man in America called Balbir Singh Sodhi was killed in the petrol station that he owned purely because he was wearing a turban. So you can understand why for these communities, when things like turbans and hijabs or headscarves are being worn as a fashion accessory on a runway, it can be seen as really harmful because those host communities often can't do those things safely. So Gucci did actually put out a public apology. They recognized how this can be seen as appropriation, how they were offending. And if they did ever want to use the hijab or the turban in the future, they would use models that actually wear the hijab or the turban. So that's one example of where we've seen it in the fashion industry. But I thought I'd share some examples of some good forms of appreciation. A few years ago, I was involved in a project with Kensington Palace down in London. They wanted me involved in their Victoria exhibition that they were starting at the palace. And what they recognized is that they couldn't have an exhibition on Queen Victoria without highlighting her involvement in the British Empire. And what they also recognized that whilst exhibiting lots of cultural items, historical items from South Asia, that they needed to get those communities involved in that exhibition too. So what we did is we involved a lot of the local community around South Asian, Kensington Palace, a lot of who are South Asians, to come in to see the exhibition before it went on display. And I ran a number of poetry workshops with the local community where they got to write poems about their reflections on those historical items that were about to go onto exhibition. So when the exhibition went live, all those items went out on display alongside the poems from the South Asian community about how they felt about those particular moments in Victoria's history. So that's just one example of where we can do better, especially in the historical and heritage space, to make sure we aren't appropriating cultures and ignoring host communities. That's just a great way of getting them involved. I'll give you another example within the healthcare system. I've been doing a lot of work with the NHS over the last couple of years around how we can use practices like meditation, yoga, mindfulness to support people's mental health and well-being. These things have been a part of South Asian culture for thousands of years and have really shown us the benefit of how they can support our mental health and mental well-being. So what the health services have recognized is not only can we use these practices to support people's health and well-being, but also to recognize where they've come from. And they will also teach patients and participants about the history of those things, of mindfulness, meditation, yoga. Again, that's a great way of showing how we can share our cultural knowledge, we can share our cultural understanding by understanding where these things come from. So of course we can have white yoga teachers, of course we can have white meditation teachers, as long as there's an understanding of where these things had first come from. That's ultimately how we can appreciate one another's cultures without appropriating them. Now, before we finish up, and we do have a little bit of time for a Q&A, if anybody's got any questions, any comments, or anything you'd like me to clarify, because it is a complicated topic, we will have a little Q&A if anybody's got any questions. But before we finish up, I just wanted to share one more poem with you all. I really do love to end my talks, my sessions, my workshop on a really positive note. So this is a poem called The Moment. It's not directly related to appropriation, but what it is related to is how we can be more empathetic and understanding to one another. I performed this poem a few years ago at Royal Albert Hall. It's a very special one for me. So this is The Moment. The moment that you realize that true contentment can be found when you serve others, all other desires will seem so small. The moment you see joy in another being's eyes because of your own selfless actions, life starts to make a lot more sense. The moment you begin to act as the reflection of the visions that you have for a better world, things will begin to change. And the moment you become aware of your responsibility for the betterment of others, you'll see such beauty in life. The moment you begin to be more concerned about learning to love than to be loved, positive emotions of oceanic depths will engulf you. The moment you become more conscious about understanding others than to be understood, that's when your mind will truly begin to learn. And the moment you begin to comprehend that our enemies are not physical flesh or blood, yet they are our own thoughts, peace will begin to conquer. The moment that you learn how to listen rather than to always be heard, you will hear languages you thought your mind could never fathom. And the moment that we accept that life will always be about mastering and relearning, conquering and climbing, this journey will feel so smooth. And the moment you allow yourself to believe that we can change this world for the better, we will do it. Because life is but these moments where we learn, change, grow, and give. So go live your moments. Thank you. Hey, I think we've got a little bit of time for questions. I think we do have a roaming mic that's going to come round. If anybody would like to... Oh, we've got some hands up already at the back. I think we have a mic that will come round.
Hi. It's interesting to hear what you said about the Kensington Palace sort of exhibition, because I think, for me, remembering my school trips to places like the British Museum and the V&A are probably the more sort of egregious examples of cultural appropriation. So do you think actually we are sort of learning to do a bit better in that space, and how would you see us sort of developing and improving there, I suppose? And then I did have a second question I was intending to ask before I came, that actually a lot of, I guess, white music artists are definitely inspired by, you know, music originating from African-American backgrounds. So you think about Adele, clearly inspired by soul, and I think further back, the Rolling Stones inspired by sort of blues music. Do you think the music industry does a decent job, or how do you think they should sort of, I guess, make their appreciation clearer in those spaces?
Thank you. Yeah, no, brilliant question there. Two areas where we see obviously a lot of this taking place in the history and kind of heritage space, and then obviously in music as well. The first one about history and heritage, yeah, you're absolutely right. Kind of growing up when we'd go to a lot of these museums across the UK, but across the Western world, and we would see these cultural items that have been taken from other parts of the world, but never kind of much understanding or knowledge or history given on the context of what happened there, where did they come from, why they were taken. But I think we're now doing a lot better. I think museums and heritage spaces recognize that, yes, they've got thousands of objects within their heritage spaces that have been taken or stolen. And I know there's lots of conversations about, oh, should these items be given back? And there's ongoing debates about this. But I think ultimately what we can do better is making sure that education is really there, so that those historical spaces of heritage are showing the best and, I don't want to say honest, because what is honest history, but the kind of most inclusive narrative of history that they can convey. Those spaces of heritage have a responsibility of doing that. And I think we are hopefully moving in the right direction, that these spaces are recognizing they need to do that work. The second one about the music space is perhaps a more complicated one. But what I have seen is, and some of those artists that you've mentioned, and obviously we can see things like music, it has been influenced of this global influence of how we do take elements of different parts of music from all parts of the world. Again, as long as it's recognized, as long as it's appreciated, then I would say that is not appropriation taking place. If we go back to the definition of what appropriation is, it's when things are being taken without any recognition of where those elements have come from, and no recognition of those host communities. As long as that recognition, that understanding, that education, that appreciation is taking place in the music industry, then I guess we, again, are moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Hiya. I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming along and giving this talk. It was incredibly insightful.
Thank you.
Also want to acknowledge the work that goes into that. I know Western audiences can sometimes not be particularly receptive to these concepts, so I just want to acknowledge the work that clearly goes into all of that.
Thank you.
My question around it is, when it comes to cultural items that from closed practices, like hair locks, for example, when it comes to discussing this with fellow white people, is there a good way to approach that? Because in my experience, you kind of can easily drift into colorism about, like, do you or do you not have the heritage for these things? And you almost don't want to become a cultural police for people that actually do have a background. Do you know a good way of, like, approaching other people and gently challenging, for example, if you see white people with hair locks that they might not have the heritage or respect?
Yeah.
Is there a good way of doing that?
That's a really good question there, because, yeah, it isn't ultimately that, oh, somebody has to look like they come from that cultural background for us to assume whether they should be adopting that cultural tradition or not. So we can't always make that assumption. I guess just asking the question in the most empathetic way possible. Again, this is kind of conversations around allyship. I know a lot of the time some of my white peers and white friends sometimes are afraid to ask questions because they don't want to come across as offensive. But what I tell my mates is that it's better if you do ask those questions and explain that you are ignorant in that situation, that you just don't know, and that you want to do better and that you do want to understand. So just kind of approaching it in that kind of most open and empathetic way possible, I think is a great way to adopt kind of the best way to handle those situations. Another great book that I definitely recommend for specifically what we're talking about there, about especially when it's perhaps less clear about what culture people belong to and whether they are a part of it. A great book that just came out a few months ago by another friend of mine, his name's Jasa Alawalia. He just released a book called Both Not Half, about his dual heritage of being white and South Asian, and that he appears as a white man, but obviously is half or not half, as he describes, South Asian, and how he's had to navigate that throughout his entire life. As a white Punjabi-speaking man, he's never known where his space is. His mum was white, his dad was Punjabi. His book has brilliantly described how to handle some of these situations, both if you're within that situation or as an outsider as well. So I definitely recommend that book for some of those particular situations.
Hi there. I just wondered what your view would be on this. I was having a conversation recently with my son, who's quite involved in putting on amateur musicals. And they're always looking for suggestions of what to put on. And I said, oh, why don't you do West Side Story? Nobody's done it for quite a long time. And he said, oh, no, we can't do that because that's cultural appropriation. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, we live in the south of England, in Portsmouth, mm-hmm. and we don't have a big Latino population. And for those who don't know, about half of the cast in West Side Story would be of Latino origin.
Yeah.
And that completely blew my mind because I was like, well, if we don't have any, why can't someone else play it? I didn't really get it.
Yeah.
I just wonder what your view was on that.
Oh, that's it's a great topic. And this goes not only in, like, I guess, theatre, but in film as well. This has been a question and a debate over the years of should actors play roles that they are not perhaps from that heritage themselves. And we've seen that be the case in films and in theatre for decades, that people have taken on roles of heritage or historical identity that are not their own. I guess in that particular situation, it's quite a tricky one, because if you don't have those communities there, then what do you do? But at the same time, if you don't share those stories, how will people know either? That one, I to be honest, I don't have an answer for. What I can see in the film industry, what people are trying to do better is making sure they are providing those roles to people and actors from those communities. And that doesn't necessarily just mean skin color. I think it was Denzel Washington made a really great comment on this a couple of years ago on a film that he was working on, that he was like, it wasn't about him being a black man. It was more about him being from that particular community and that space and that geography of understanding that context of a certain culture and community, which made sense for him to take on that role. So it isn't always about skin color. It's more about kind of the cultural context of what perhaps people have been around and grown up around. So yeah, again, it's a tricky one. And in that particular situation, I'm not sure what the best answer is. But props to your son for recognizing why that might not be okay and just questioning it. Because a lot of the time we don't even ask that question and we just jump into something straight away. But that's great that he was actually just questioning whether this will be a right thing to do or not.
Hello. I want to just echo the thanks for sharing your experiences
Thank
and
you.
Your insights on that. Fascinating. I'm from a mixed race background, and so my culture futures between Mauritian and English. Mauritian itself is quite a mix of cultures anyway.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I struggle with when we talk about cultural appropriation and appreciation is that, to a certain extent, cultures have never existed in isolation. They've always interplayed with each other and therefore have borrowed and taken and given to each other.
Yeah.
And we live in a time at the moment where there is a lot of kind of like a resurgence of racial identity, shall we say. That's the phrase that I would use. And I find that quite disturbing, because I think one of the things that I enjoy about being mixed race is exactly that ability to be part of a melting pot of things. That's not to deny where things come from, but at the same time, not all cultural tradition is good. There are many cultural traditions which are bad, where people are oppressed, and that is part of the culture. And we often present culture as positive, but it's not necessarily positive. There's a history of that where there is horrible things that have happened to people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to me, I'm wondering, how do we deal with this at this point in time, where there's this resurgence of a very strong cultural identity, which isn't necessarily entirely bad.
Yeah.
But also, we live in a time where we're global and we mix, and that's how it's happening. Should we be trying to build walls? Should we be trying to create enclaves? Should cultures become museum pieces? how do we navigate that? And I'm not expecting necessarily a clear answer. I'm more interested in your views on it.
Yeah.
Because it's very interesting to hear you speak about it.
No, thank you. And everything you've said there is absolutely valid about what even is culture. Like, if we had to define it, what does that even mean? And absolutely, in a globalized world, this has been something actually has been a part of our histories for centuries, that we do take elements from other parts of cultures, depending on where we live in, the geographies that we exist in. So there's always an element of that. But I think this, what you're describing there about kind of people trying to re-identify their kind of their racial identity, their cultural heritage, why is that happening? I guess that's happening because people, I wish we could walk around in a world where I'm not seen as a brown woman. I'm just seen as Jaspreet, and loved and appreciated as just Jaspreet. But unfortunately, I do have to walk around and will be seen as a brown woman, especially in spaces where I may be one of the only people of color, women of color in those spaces. And until I'm not seen as just that, I do have to keep identifying myself as one and making it clear of who I am and what my culture is and why I love it and why it should be appreciated, until we get to a place and time where that isn't the case. I hope that answers your question there. There isn't a clear answer, unfortunately, and I wish we could live in a world where that isn't the case, that we can just love and appreciate all cultures and we're not being seen by this external exterior. Just to mention, my poetry stage name is Behind the Netra, and that's how I introduced myself for a number of years as a poet. And Netra is a Sanskrit word, which means, it's kind of got the meaning of our eyes are the window to our soul. Netra being this concept of understanding who we are behind this kind of physical realm. Who are we on a deeper level? So my poetry, my writing, my research was all about understanding who are we behind the netra. Remove all this physical appearance of what we see when we meet another person, and who are we just as human beings? And that is a lot of what my poetry is about. And that is what I really hope the world can be about. But I think we still got a long way to go to get there.
Thanks for what you said. It's been so interesting for me. I've got so many questions in
my head.
Thank you. One of them was, where does responsibility lie for showing whether it's appreciation or appropriation? Because I lived in a culture very different from my own for a good number of years. Mm-hmm. And some of those things I've adopted, for example.
Yeah.
It might be a dress or it might be the way I do something.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't necessarily... You know, that was a long time ago, and I wouldn't necessarily explain to people. So am I at fault if people see me and then feel appropriated because that's something I've adopted as living embedded in that culture for a long time? Where does the responsibility lie? Because I might dress in a certain way that you might think, well, she's not from there. Why is she wearing that? Mm. Whereas actually for many years I did. So
yeah.
That word of responsibility is kind of going around in my head. I know when I go into another culture where my responsibility lies, but where does it lie when I live where I live?
Mm-hmm.
But kind of using the culture of where I did live.
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. And that's where, again, a lot of these questions come up about... Often I get asked questions like, oh, if I've visited another country and I've bought cultural items from that country and I now display them in my house, but I'm doing it because I appreciate that culture, I love that culture, I educated myself on why those certain things are being used as a part of those cultures, is that okay? And in those circumstances, again, that context is absolutely fine because it isn't taking without any understanding. And obviously in your situation, that was never the case either. It wasn't taking without any knowledge or understanding. So I feel that word responsibility is a huge kind of weight to bear on yourself of having to feel responsible to explain that to people all the time. But I feel like each and every single one of us does have that sense of responsibility. And hopefully it doesn't feel like too much of a burden and it doesn't feel like too much of a weight, but it feels like something that you can take pride in too, that you got to learn and love and appreciate and be a part of that culture, and that you have a really positive responsibility of sharing that with others, of how you are a part of that. to, yeah, I guess it is a part of your own individual responsibility to explain that to others if that conversation ever comes up, if anybody ever questions why you might be wearing certain things, to explain why you were a part of it. But that wouldn't be appropriation. That is actually appreciating where those things have come from.
Thank you again. So it's like there's two questions in my mind. One is a more intellectual type question. One is more personal type question. Uh-huh. We often sometimes hear there's a backlash against cultural appreciation because one culture is being appreciated, but the other culture, whatever that culture may be, starts feeling hard done by. And then I've been in personal situations where the majority looking person,
yes,
would say, I'm feeling like all the ads are about people that don't look like me. And that took me by surprise, and I've never had an answer to that. So what happens, you know, do you have any perspectives, any views, any answers in those kind of situations?
That second point there about where people that are in the majority feel like they're not being reflected. In the kindest and most loving way possible, I would have to say to those people that for a long time they have been represented, and for a long time they have been seen everywhere, and for a long time that is the only faces that we ever saw. So if sometimes they see a face that doesn't look like theirs or a voice that doesn't sound like theirs come up in certain ads or wearing certain fashion clothes or shown in marketing from time to time, then really they've got to question why they feel so insecure about that. And again, trying to say that in the most empathetic way possible, sometimes it can be frustrating because for those that do come from minority or marginalized communities, it's like, well, we haven't been seen for so long, so that's a feeling we've had to hold our whole lives. It's okay if you hold that burden for about 10 minutes for us. So yeah, I guess in the most loving way possible, that's how I would respond, that historically for a long time, that is what has been represented in the mainstream. Now we are just seeing a reflection of our global society a little bit more, and that's okay to see. So yeah, it's sometimes difficult to respond in those situations. Sometimes you might not feel safe to say it. Sometimes you might not feel secure in saying it. So obviously consider the context and the time. Do you feel comfortable saying anything in that moment, or would you like to kind of assess it at another time where you feel more comfortable? Always question that first, because you would never want to put yourself in a place where you don't feel comfortable to actually raise it. Again, that's something I mentioned in the book, specifically in the chapter on microaggressions. Whenever we face any of these moments of microaggressions, a microaggression is sometimes a more subtle form of kind of racial injustice. Racism is sometimes more overt. It's a bit clearer when it's happening, but microaggressions are sometimes these kind of covert comments or assumptions, or I would even say that particular thing that you've just said there does sound a little bit like a microaggression, about how to handle those moments. And I've given like tips and advice on how to handle those situations in a way that's comfortable and safe for you. So yeah, I hope that helps.
Anyone else?
Yeah. Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I work for an international NGO that works in, among other things, on areas like FGM or child marriage, mm-hmm, or other harmful practices. And so there's a lot of conversation about how do you do that in a way that's not attacking someone's culture. And yeah, I just wondered, yeah, if you had any comments on that.
Yeah, big topic there and big question there and a really heavy one to finish on. But yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up again. I've spoken about a number of industries today. We spoke about fashion, heritage, music, film, theatre. But charity is another big space where we've got to consider some of these conversations. Obviously, big conversations around kind of the white saviour complex, as well as issues like you've just mentioned there that can sometimes be a part of cultural practices. How do we handle these situations sensitively? my answer to that, again, is to have those communities, those host communities, as involved as possible, so that you're getting those people from those communities, from those cultures, from those particular areas and geographies, people that are experts in those particular fields and areas involved in that conversation, involved in that work, to make sure that it's being handled as sensitively as possible. I think what we've seen historically happen in those charity spaces is a bit of that white savior complex, that those communities have never been involved in the actual conversation or the services or the needs that need to be kind of put forward. Now I hope to see that the charity spaces are doing better there, that they are really getting those communities involved to make sure that they're doing the right things for them and serving those communities the best that they can. Thank you for that. Thank you for your question.
Okay.
Thank you, Jaspreet.
No, thank you.
It's been incredibly
Thank you all so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.